welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Glad you've tuned in. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, News Director Dave Thompson joins me for a roundup of the headlines that are shaping North Dakota and the region. Then film critic Matt Olien breaks down the new Naked Gun reboot. Does Liam Neeson deliver the laughs? And Chuck Lura takes us out on the prairie, where August blooms, bucks strut, and the night sky puts on a show. And we begin Main Street today with a Conversations on Healthcare, where issues, policies, and people shaping healthcare today are explored. Co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner each bring 4 decades of experience in overcoming barriers to care through their leadership in community health centers. Today, their guest is Dr. Mark K. Updegrove. He's a presidential historian, author, and president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation, a former director of the LBJ Presidential Library, and presidential historian for ABC News. Dr. Updegrove joins the show to reflect on the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, President Lyndon Johnson's sweeping Great Society vision, and how those landmark programs continue to influence American healthcare nearly 60 years later.
Well, Mark Updegrove, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Mark. Delighted to be here.
Oh, that's great. And let's just start off by asking you really to get in the Wayback Machine back to 1965. What was healthcare like for elderly Americans, and how did they pay for it? And maybe talk a little bit about how severe was the economic burden for seniors.
Tremendously severe. In 1965, one-third of America's population over 65 lived in poverty. LBJ, among other things, is known for the war on poverty, the war he waged on poverty in our nation. And one of those things necessitated ensuring that Americans who couldn't afford the most basic health care needs could do so through an insurance policy allowed through Medicare. And so it's something that Harry Truman had tried to push up the hill, wasn't able to do so. John F. Kennedy did so as well. But Lyndon Johnson got it done in 1965, and it's been woven into the fabric of our country ever since.
Well, let's set the scene by talking a little bit about what was happening in the country 6 decades ago. Those were interesting times, just like these are interesting times. The U.S. had just elected Lyndon Johnson as president in his own right following John F. Kennedy's assassination. He was really at the height of his political power in a long political life. Tell us, who was he at that point, as you've come to know and understand him through history?
You know, you're absolutely right, Margaret. 1965 is the high tide of the Great Society and of the Johnson administration. He, of course, takes over as president in the wake of the assassination of John F. Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963. He rides out that year as an accidental president, becomes elected in his own right in 1964 with the largest electoral mandate in American history, 61% of the popular vote, rides into the White House with this mandate, and he knows the ephemeral nature of political capital. So he uses 1965 to get as much done as he possibly can. And during the course of that year, you see the creation of Head Start and VISTA and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Highway Beautification Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Immigration Act, the most sweeping immigration reform in the history of our country, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, the Higher Education Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the creation of Medicare and Medicaid.
Wow.
And that is 1 year of the Johnson presidency. It's stunning.
Well, you know, Margaret, I had the chance to read Robert Caro's four books on Johnson, and Mark, you know, he really was able to use his political strength to push through so many things, but in particular, the federal health insurance program. And that, as you said earlier, that was really a legacy that others had tried to get through. How did he do it?
You know, let me just go back for a moment and mention again that Truman had really pushed hard for this.
Yeah.
And I think you had the resistance of the medical community, the doctors in particular. They thought they were going to lose money if you went to a federal, you know, what they considered social medicine. John F. Kennedy, the year of his death, had a huge rally at Madison Square Garden to push for Medicare. Lyndon Johnson did it for a number of reasons. Number one, he was a student of power. I think he understood intrinsically the way that power worked. And he could work on lawmakers in a way that Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy could not. He just had this great ability to get things done. Number two, I think it was an idea whose time had come. You had two-thirds majorities, Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate, and there was this confluence of circumstances that made it possible for progressive reform like that to go into place, despite the violent resistance of so many Republicans, and including a Republican named Ronald Reagan, who had yet to be the governor of California and president of the United States, but was a very active voice in the Republican Party and said that it would be the ruin of America to see something like Medicare and Medicaid go through. It would lead to greater socialism in our nation.
Well, major legislation like this that is durational, long-lasting, changes over time. When you look back to the founding, the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, what did it look like compared to what it looks like today?
Well, a lot smaller. But let me just say, Margaret, that I mentioned those things that Lyndon Johnson was able to do in 1965. I also mentioned the war on poverty. That was one of his objectives. Another objective was racial equality. And this is the guy who had pushed for the Civil Rights Act in 1964, spent a great deal of political capital to get that through. The Voting Rights Act came, as I mentioned, in 1965. But so much of Medicare at the time was to ensure greater equality in this country. There was a desegregation of hospitals that was embedded in the Medicare Act. Black Americans had far less longevity than white Americans, and the healthcare needs were so much greater for people of color than they were for white people in this nation. So there were those things that were crucial to this as well. But the Medicare and Medicaid, as any big legislation does, it evolves through time. And so the Medicare and Medicaid envisioned by and enacted by Lyndon Johnson became much greater through time as our needs as a nation became greater.
You know, I really want to pull up on that thought about evolving, because who would have thought back then that Medicaid would loom so large in our country today, right? 90, 100 million Americans, 68 or so on Medicare, still important. But you see this popularity of Medicaid, and it was, was it an afterthought? How did Medicaid get put into the Medicare bill?
I think it was very much a product of the war on poverty, Mark. As I mentioned earlier, the heavy concentration on the alleviation of poverty in our country, which was chronic, about between a fifth and a quarter of Americans lived in poverty. And as I mentioned, a third of Americans over 65 lived in poverty. That number was far greater for people of color. It was far greater for rural Americans. So you had these major factors that had Johnson not only concentrating on Medicare, but the Medicaid program, which I don't think Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy had imagined quite to the degree that Lyndon Johnson had.
Well, certainly all major legislation has its fierce opponents, and these programs were no exception. You called out Ronald Reagan a little while ago and said that Ronald Reagan said that the Medicare idea would be a step towards socialized medicine in this country.
On September 1st, 1964, Senator Barry M. Goldwater interrupted his vacation cruise and headed for shore in a big hurry. Destination, Washington, D.C. He arrived just in time to cast his vote.
No.
Then he turned around and headed back. Senator Goldwater flew across the continent twice, almost 6,000 miles, to vote against a program of hospital insurance for older Americans. As he said in the Atlanta Constitution on January 26th, 1963, I've got my own Medicare plan. I've got an intern or a son-in-law. Flip answers do not solve the problems of human beings. President Johnson wants a program of hospital insurance for older Americans. He is determined to see this program passed in the next Congress. Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
You know, historically, we've seen continued attacks like this. How did he respond to that? Was it just politically, get the majority and push it through? Or was there a reasoned argument that he was putting forth that said, no, this is not socialized medicine, it's still private, it's still going to be privatized? There was no call within, as I understand it, within the Medicare legislation to take control away from physicians. It was very much about actually opening up an entire new kind of line of reimbursement for physicians and hospitals. Wasn't it across the country?
That's exactly right, Margaret. So there's a lot of education, as there is with any big bill that's transformational. You have to educate lawmakers, you have to educate lobbyists, you have to educate constituents. And I think there was a concerted effort to do that. There was also actions on the other side to do the same thing. You had doctors' wives holding coffees and playing records of Ronald Reagan, as I mentioned earlier, talking about what an evil Medicare would be and how it would lead to socialism in our country. So you had educational efforts and propaganda efforts on both sides. But I think what Lyndon Johnson did uniquely, perhaps not uniquely, but certainly distinctly, was he had this ability to persuade. And so much of that came from what was legendarily known as the Johnson treatment. Johnson had an ability to get people on his side by horse trading or cajoling or threatening or flattering or whatever he needed to do to get something over the finish line. And he had an uncanny ability to do that, which explains the litany of transformational legislation that I enumerated a moment ago.
He would physically get in people's space as well. So he used...
He was big.
He was big. He would use many, many, many tactics. You know, we talked a little bit about the sort of the opponents have really tried to shape the debate over time, really claiming the program will lead to sort of economic disaster. And we've heard from the American Enterprise Institute their projections really at the turn of the century, 1999, that Medicare would reach insolvency in the next two decades. I think that's been trotted out for many decades. That didn't happen. Is it in part just because of how popular it is and that Congress is always going to find a way to keep this afloat?
I think that's right. And there's the concern among Republicans about big government. That's always been a plank in the party. That's always been something that they have beat the drum on, reducing the size of government. It's ironic because you see with the so-called big, beautiful bill that it makes our government in some ways much bigger, certainly makes our debt much bigger, and it cuts Medicare and Medicaid substantially while giving the wealthiest Americans a major tax cut. So it is in some ways antithetical but paradoxical. But I think once again, we see those programs, Medicare and Medicaid, under siege.
You know, if I think back to the Affordable Care Act run-up summers, remember all the town halls with seniors with their placards, no government health insurance, keep your hands off my Medicare. Medicare had come to be seen as the private insurance and a really positive benefit, like getting Social Security. Interestingly, we've never seen that kind of public support from all people for Medicaid, right? Medicare, it's like hands off. Medicaid still remains unequal among the states. Do you think that was something that would have surprised or disappointed Johnson to look across the states and see how much variation there is based on where you live in this country? Your access to Medicare is pretty much the same, assuming you have providers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But your access to Medicaid is not the same. There's been a different level of state intervention. What would he have made of that, do you think?
I think surprised, no, Margaret, but disappointed, yes. Surprised, no, because you were seeing the same thing really related to civil rights in particular. Look at, segregation at the time. You had the Deep South, which was behaving very differently from other states. And so there was a certain sectional differences. But disappointed, yes, because there are a lot of people who could benefit from Medicaid. And for instance, in Texas, where I live and where I work, we have a government that has refused Medicaid to the detriment of many of its poorest citizens. So Johnson, a Texan, certainly would have been disappointed by that as well.
What do you think about that? Because, you know, Texas is a great example. I think there are, Margaret, only 10 states that haven't signed up for the ACA, Florida and Texas being the two biggest ones. But, Mark, probably $10, $20 billion lost for the hospital system, the private providers in the state. And then as you looked at this sort of assault on Medicaid now, there has been some really interesting congressional district by congressional district of the percentage of Medicaid people. And you look at some of these much poorer states from West Virginia on down through the South, where there's, you know, huge amounts of dollars coming into their state and obviously people in need. What do you make of why there's a disconnect in the minds of the people who are opposed to that? In many cases, Republicans, it sort of doesn't make a lot of sense. They're not voting. There's self-interest. This isn't the small proportion that happened in the late 60s or early 70s in terms of Medicaid's impact. This has been an enormous sea change.
I think a lot of it is our information ecosystem, which I think is the longest or the biggest long-term threat to our democracy. There is this conservative media ecosystem where their audiences are being served up misinformation, disinformation relating to the federal government, which has been vilified and demonized. A big government has been attacked, and whether it is beneficial to the folks who are consuming those programs or not. And I think a lot of people are, because of that misinformation and disinformation, again, to your point, Mark, voting against their own interests. That's nothing new. But given the fact that there is such a fragmented media landscape, I think the ability to purvey, to serve up misinformation and disinformation is much greater.
I think they had some realization, because in the bill they pushed all of the cuts past the midterm elections, right? Most people were asking, I know we get asked all the time, Margaret, how's the organization going to be impacted by the Medicaid cuts? And I got to remind them and say, it really happens in January 2027,
after
a little after the midterms.
That's right. That's exactly right. And of course, the timing of that is not coincidental, right?
Right.
So it's unfortunate. And again, I look at the media landscape as a major culprit here as well.
You know, it's so great to have a chance to talk to you with your depth of knowledge of this period in time when all this was happening. And though I hadn't planned on it, let me take the opportunity to ask you. It's this time of the signing, 1968. It's also the time of the creation of the community health centers in the United States, the beginning of the movement, which we've been part of for half a century. Sergeant Shriver authorizes some of the demonstration projects, and the statute that ultimately created community health centers gets signed into law. Do you think that figured anywhere in his thinking as well, that there needed to be a delivery system to make sure that poor people in particular had access to health care, or was that all being handled by other people and he was razor focused on the Medicare and Medicaid bills writ large? Just curious if you have any insights into that.
No, I think this is part of LBJ's sweeping vision for a better America. I mean, all this stuff was interwoven. You know, we tend to look at the great society in different categories. There's health care, and there's education, and there's immigration and civil rights and poverty alleviation. But ultimately, if you look at the legislation itself, I alluded to this with Medicare a moment ago, all this stuff is interwoven, right? There's a major poverty component in Medicare. There's a major race component in Medicare. There's a major education component.
Exactly. Right? Another big piece of it.
Jimmy. Yep.
Right.
Right.
Right. So he's thinking in a big way about all this stuff.
Bring him back.
Factors into the legislation, right? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think someone who spoke truth to power all the time, he was a real champion so many things, such a consequential president. And we shouldn't forget that in 1965, President Johnson also signed the Older Americans Act into law. Maybe talk a little bit about what the law covered and how does it affect the health of seniors today?
You know, so Medicare was part of it, right? Ensuring that the older Americans who couldn't afford it could have the most basic health care needs met, but there were other needs that older Americans had that weren't embedded in Medicare. So there were a number of measures that he took to ensure that older Americans were being thought of, that we were thinking about the elderly community. You know, he used to talk about LBJ, that when he was young, people would go over to the poorhouse. And effectively what that meant was that there was an older member of a household who had health care needs that weren't being met, and they would essentially send them someplace to die. That was almost a dying center, right? It was hospice care before that term was readily known. And so he saw many people going over to the poorhouse because they couldn't afford to be tended to. And so the aim of his administration, or the aim of these efforts around the elderly Americans, were not just about healthcare, but other aspects of tending to our elderly in the American, throughout America.
Yeah, that
that expression, AAA. The poorhouse, I remember growing up. Yeah.
You all heard that. And I think that term to some degree evolved.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was about something very specific. It was a euphemism for essentially sending an elderly member of your family out to die.
Well, you recently released a new book titled Make Your Mark, Lessons in Character from 7 Presidents. And it includes a chapter about George W. Bush's work to start the PEPFAR program, which provides, as we all know, HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment and care to people in developing countries. Tell us, so much out there. Why did you pick this topic to include, and what lessons should we take from this section?
You know, the Greeks said 2,500 years ago that character was destiny. Mm-hmm. And I think that sentiment rings as true today as it ever has. And it's particularly true in our leadership. We need character in our leaders to ensure that we are on the right course. Character is the rudder that directs a leader's actions and decisions. And we're not seeing it. In my personal view, we're not seeing a great deal of character we're certainly not seeing a great deal of compassion from our president today. But the quality that I highlighted for George Walker Bush is about giving back. And that is very much instilled in the ethos of the Bush family. You've had it good in this country, and there's the biblical proverb that George W. Bush adhered to whom much is given, much is required. Mm-hmm. And during the beginning part of the millennium, the AIDS epidemic was ravaging much of the world, including in particular sub-Saharan Africa, where it threatened to wipe out certain sects of the population. And Bush realized he could do something about it. And that led to the creation of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which since it went into place in 2003, has saved the lives of over 28 million citizens of the world. That's more than the population of Australia for a relatively minimal investment. So that's a great example of giving back. And it's something that we should be aware of, something that we should be proud of and should continue to sustain.
Margaret, well, you remember last year we were at Aspen Institute, had the opportunity to sit with Tony Fauci on the anniversary of PEPFAR. And he told a great story about W in terms of he got him in his office. He said, what do you think this is going to cost? And Tony sort of used a little number. He said, Tony, you go over to Africa and figure out if we can solve this problem. Let me worry about the money. So he was really very committed to this. Didn't matter the size, he just knew the importance of it. And I'd also say, probably surprising on the community health center world, he was a big supporter, which, sort of came out of the blue for many people in the movement. But he was also realized, and probably just growing up in Texas and realizing the importance of taking care of the people who you represent. So character really mattered, and we saw a lot of that in his actions. Mark, you've had a varied career, including leadership roles in media. Why is presidential history so important to you, and why do you think it matters?
I was, as it happens, Mark, I was at the Harry Truman Library yesterday in Independence, Missouri, right outside of Kansas City. And Harry Truman said something which I've quoted often. He said, the only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. And you can learn a lot about who we are and where we're going by looking at our history. And so I think it's you can see it in particular in our presidential history. Again, because of the character of our leaders, we've seen our country steered in certain directions, making certain pivotal decisions based on the American values that we represent, that America is known for. So I think the history has always been of great interest to me, and I think to a large extent, we can see our future by looking at our past.
You know, you talked about a moment we're pivoting now, and I'm wondering, is there anything from the Johnson history in terms of how we bring people back together? Certainly, there's been a fragmentation that's existed in the political landscape. What's the local anecdote to what may be, very rough winds coming out of Washington?
Well, there are two things. One of the things that folks, I think, should know is that, those programs I enumerated, the 1965 legislation, that's just 1965. But if you look at the accomplishments of the Great Society, they're much greater than that. Mm-hmm. That's the high tide of the Great Society, but they go on and on. And we hear about the eradication of government from the Trump administration, and he's often vilifies Joe Biden or Barack Obama or Bill Clinton, even George W. Bush. But at the end of the day, the eradication of government is principally about the elimination of a lot of the programs that came in the Great Society. That's what's at stake here. The Great Society was in large measure the foundation of modern America. So much that has been woven into the fabric of our nation was in those that legislation that I mentioned. I think LBJ had a phrase that I loved. He used to invoke a phrase that was that he had learned in his youth, and that is any jackass can kick down a barn door, but it takes a damn fine carpenter to build one. And I think what you see singularly throughout the Johnson administration is this effort to build a better America. Some things succeeded, some things failed. But we did become, I think, ultimately a better country because of the things that were enacted in the 1960s. I see a lot of destruction today. I see a lot of the tearing down of things, but I don't see a vision for what we can build in place toward a better America. And that's something I'd like to see in the days, months, and years ahead.
As would we. Mark Updegrove, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare. And thanks to our audience for being here. Just a reminder to subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X, and share your thoughts and comments about this program. We love to hear from you. Take care and be well.
That was a Conversations on Healthcare with hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner. Their guest today, Dr. Mark K. Updegrove. He's an author, historian, and president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation. He gave his reflections on the legacy of Medicare, Medicaid, and the character of presidential leadership. To learn more about his work, including his latest book, Make Your Mark, Lessons in Character from Seven Presidents, visit markupdegrove.com. Still ahead on Main Street, headlines with Dave Thompson, slapstick with Matt Olien talking about Liam Neeson, and a prairie symphony of sunflowers, stargazing, and strutting bucks. That's all after this news.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Dave Thompson now joins us like he does each and every Thursday in the Main Street studio. Dave, we're going to review the latest North Dakota and regional news headlines. Welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you very much.
Dave, a lot of talk this week about the Fargo shootings that happened now almost a week ago. What's the latest relative to the investigations and the future of Fargo Police Chief Dave Zabalski?
Now, this is interesting how this kind of has mushroomed into something else. You had the two distinct shooting events, where two people have passed away and then there's somebody still in critical condition. You've got one suspect, you're looking for another suspect. But that happened early Sunday morning. It was not till almost Monday before the police chief would make a statement on it. And there are people on the Fargo City Commission who are not happy about that. But apparently there's going to be some discussions with the chief to determine, you know, how to better handle communications. And at the same time, that night, you had an assault that which was fairly close to the downtown shooting location, and that involved the sheriff's department because they had a mutual aid pact, and the sheriff was not available to talk about it until yesterday. So I don't know at this point if or what the future is for Chief Cebulski, but these things kind of, you know, take on a life of their own once in a while.
They really do. And the bottom line question, Dave, I think that people are wondering is Fargo a safe community?
And I think that's a reasonable question at this point.
A lot of communication can help us understand that, and I think it's the communication end of it that hasn't been totally forthcoming, transparent, and immediate.
I think that is the issue. You know, even Chief Cebulski says, yeah, we blew it.
Dave, let's move on. There's a project in North Central North Dakota that aims to keep small grocery stores open. It's a new initiative, and you've covered this.
I have covered this. This is fascinating to me. What they want to do is an area around Minot, North Dakota. Maybe have Minot where the hub is, where you have a kind of a warehouse for these grocery stores. And then they would ship food out to smaller grocery stores up and around that area. And this is patterned after one that's actually kind of working now in Walsh County and northeastern North Dakota. They've got something similar. But this is a larger thing because they're going to actually have, you know, a food distribution center.
Ellen Huber is the Rural Development Director for the North Dakota Association of Rural Electric Cooperatives, who's kind of leading this program, Dave, mm-hmm. and we will have her on Main Street on Monday. So I look forward to that conversation.
Absolutely. She's got a lot to say about the whole idea about preventing food deserts.
Dave, an interesting story you covered is a no-brainer to me, yet the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services has to offer training to their employees on the proper use of smartphones.
You know, they're very interesting. He brought this up at the North Dakota DOGE committee meeting, and he said he has noticed, and of course this is Health and Human Service, he has noticed people are spending an awful lot of time scrolling or looking at their phones. They spend an awful lot of time, and he said what we need to do is get out of that habit of looking and scrolling at your cell phone, and you're probably going to be more efficient and be able to do more at your job. So they're not talking about this as a punishment thing, but they're holding some stuff at DHS today to talk about people's addiction to their smartphones and what things they can do to get them away from looking at the phone all the time.
I'm not trying to think what we would call it's not a bell to bell ban, maybe a punch in to punch out ban.
Maybe that's it, yes.
All right, Dave, another sad story. A Grand Forks food pantry has closed because of shortages of food.
I know, and that's another thing. We're talking about food deserts. They've got a shortage of food, and they need to. They're hoping to reopen now, from what I understand. But, you know, that whole Northlands Rescue Food Mission has been doing some really good work for years now in terms of getting food to the hungry. Now they're short of food, and they're hoping that donations will start picking up and they can get some supplies back and get that back going. And, boy, I hope that happens.
And it's not that people don't need the food. Those folks are still there.
Those folks are definitely still there.
Dave, Greenpeace says North Dakota judge shouldn't meddle with international free speech case is a headline. What's that about?
Well, it goes back to the DAPL protests because Greenpeace had
Dakota Access Pipeline.
The protests, Greenpeace was involved, and the Energy Transfer Partners did not only sue it in North Dakota, they took an international case about the protests that were against DAPL in the Netherlands. And what Energy Transfer is arguing is that, you know, they should be liable for that. And Greenpeace says, this is an international free speech case. You really ought to stay away from it. So I think this is going to be fascinating when the judge rules on this.
Dave Thompson, he and I review the news each and every week. He's our veteran news director here at Prairie Public. Dave, have a great weekend.
Thank you, Greg. You too.
Dave, It's Thursday. It's time to go to the movies with our good friend, Matt Olien. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Greg.
We got a comedy to review today. Matt stars Liam Neeson as Lieutenant Frank Drebin Jr. The movie, of course, is Naked Gun. Matt, what did you think of the show?
Well, I went in with high hopes. I have been reviewing a lot of serious movies, and I thought, you know what? I want an 85-minute comedy. And we all remember the first Naked Gun, 1988, with Leslie Nielsen and George Kennedy and O.J. Simpson. And the first one is so good. It's Leslie Nielsen's timing is so good. And I thought, okay, Liam Neeson, serious actor. He's played Oscar Schindler. He's played Rob Roy, Zeus, for crying out loud. So let's see him in a comedy. And boy, I did not laugh, maybe twice. And comedy's subjective. I completely understand that. The critics are kind of liking this. It made $17 million opening, so I might be in the minority here. I thought the editing beats were off, Craig. You know, when you edit a film together, those laughs have to come at the right beat for the audience. The sight gags kind of landed with a thud to me. There's this gag about the coffee cups being handed to him that they just keep doing over and over. After the third time, it's not funny anymore. Pamela Anderson is actually pretty good as the femme fatale, who shows up kind of like, you know, there's always a femme fatale in film noir and these private detective movies. She's kind of had a resurgence lately with that film, The Last Showgirl, last year. I think Neeson trying to be funny just does not work for me. Leslie Nielsen's timing was so good in Airplane and Naked Gun. The film, in the end, I just wanted to go watch the original. Akiva Schaffer is the director. And he does have a comedy background, but boy, this just makes one realize the comic timing and the genius of the Zucker brothers and Jim Abrahams, who did Airplane, who did The Naked Gun. There's just not that great sequence in this film that you're going to be still talking about like we do with the 1988 Naked Gun. The sexual innuendo stuff that you see in kind of the previews is kind of funny, but it really doesn't land either when Pamela Anderson is in Liam Neeson's apartment. But I think ultimately it's kind of the casting and the editing beats that I think miss here a little bit. I get Neeson's trying to reinvent his persona from, you know, the tough guy from Taken and Schindler and all this stuff. And I get that can be funny to go against type like that. The screening I was at, this is interesting, and I'll tell you, comedy's subjective. The two older couples who were there were laughing hard. There were two younger guys in the audience, younger than me. We didn't hear a peep out of those guys. So yeah, it's interesting. It's what you bring to the table, Craig, I think, as a viewer. It's what you bring to the theater from your past, what you think is funny, what you think is not funny. But it just didn't work for me. And I wanted to like this. I wanted to go to a comedy. You know, I need a comedy right now. It looks like I'm in the minority. A couple of my friends have liked it. But another good friend of mine, who I will name John Cox, he's a history professor over at NDSU, and he's into this stuff too. And he didn't like it either. And he warned me about it, but I had to make my own call on this. And, you know, I'm a tough grader and I want things to be good. And if they're not quite up to snuff, then, you know, I got to call it as I see it. So I would just caution viewers, look, my taste in this might be different than yours. So I'm urging people to go if they want to go see it, if they want to have a comedy.
You mentioned Zucker, David Zucker, the original creator. I read where he's declined to watch or attach credit to this reboot.
Yes.
How influential can that be driving these sequels or these reboots forward?
Yeah, he's not involved in this. And I think you can see when you watch the movie that he's not involved in this. I think his hand would have been a steadying hand on something like this. You know, there is some homage to the original film. If people have seen the original, they know that there's a beaver sight gag that's pretty funny in the original, and there is a scene where you see a beaver in the background, and it's supposed to be funny, but it doesn't quite come off. But yeah, I think it's obvious David Zucker's not involved in this, and it needed something like that. His hand in Airplane and Naked Gun, and the hand of his brother Jerry and the late Jim Abrahams. something like that was needed here. And yeah, he's not involved in this, and I think it shows. And not that you're trying to we are trying to reboot it, obviously, but you don't want it to be exactly the same as the original, and it's not, but there's just not this, there's not the one or two sequences that that you're going to laugh about in 20 years. To me, there wasn't. So I think it might be making money because people want to go see a comedy right now. I think that's, it's probably hitting at the right time, whether it's good or bad. People just want to go and laugh for 85, 90 minutes, and that's fine. Just like music, Craig, comedy is very subjective on screen and in television shows. And, you know, I never thought Jerry Lewis was funny, for example. And some people think he's a genius, especially in France. You know, so there's another one where I've met people over the years that think he's hilarious. And I've met people like my dad hated him, didn't think he was funny at all. So it's a very subjective thing. I just don't think the editing beats come off. And I think a David Zucker hand would have made those editing beats just a little funnier. Danny Houston plays the villain. He's kind of good as this crazy villain, megalomaniac. And, of course, you know, Drebin happens on to this investigation. And Drebin, you know, much like the Leslie Nielsen character, he's a cop that likes to break rules, right? He's not up to following all the rules. And that's funny. That can be funny. There's some gags about that as well.
And to your point, a little bit, sometimes comedy is generational.
It is.
The older folks in the audience loved it. The younger folks, what is going on?
And I agree.
Me and my family, me and my kids certainly differ on what mm-hmm. comedy means. Matt, what are you working on for us? What's coming down the pike for us here on your movie reviews?
Well, let's do the Fantastic Four next week. I've heard pretty good things on this, that it really kind of sticks the landing in terms of kind of this, it's set in the 1960s. You know, Vanessa Kirby, Pedro Pascal are in this. So let's give this a shot. I felt like a comedy this week. That's why I went to Naked Gun, but let's review the Fantastic Four next week. Superman exceeded my expectations earlier this summer, and Thunderbolts did, the other Marvel film that came out earlier this year. So maybe this will as well.
All right, let's move to the Oscar trivia part of our program, Matt. Two people, one I know is one of your favorites, have famously refused an Oscar. Name them.
George C. Scott for Patton, 1970. Marlon Brando for The Godfather, 1972. And curiously, they later made a film together called The Formula in 1980. And I wonder if they had a little laugh about that. Even though they both refused for different reasons, they are the two. That is right.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olean. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. August is often seen as the last breath of summer here in North Dakota, but there's far more happening in nature this time of year than meets the eye. Chuck Lura describes prairie wildflowers and velvet antler deer to meteor showers and migrating birds in this Natural North Dakota essay. North Dakota's outdoors is alive with seasonal change.
Looking out over the grasslands, there are several species of sunflowers, goldenrods, and asters putting on their annual flower show. They're announcing that school is about to start, the harvest has begun, and fall will soon take center stage. There's more going on during August than we may realize. There may be some hot August nights, perhaps reminding some of you older listeners of the opening line from that Neil Diamond song from 1969, but by the end of the month, there's often a feel of fall in the air, and perhaps even a light frost in some areas. The days, of course, are getting shorter. In Bismarck on the summer solstice back in June, sunrise and sunset were 5:47 a.m. and 9:43 p.m. respectively. By the end of August, it'll be 7 a.m. and 8:25 p.m. That's a loss of about 2.5 hours of sunlight. And, of course, the decrease will continue until the winter solstice in December. The young of the year, many animals are dispersing from their family groups. White-tailed and mule deer bucks can now be seen sporting their velvet-covered antlers, which will be put to use in determining who sires the next generation during upcoming rut. And some birds, for example, many of the shorebirds, have already headed south for the winter, while other migratory birds are beginning to form flocks and in other ways getting ready to head out. You may have noticed that the ducks on area marshes seem to have vanished for a bit. If they haven't started to show up again, they will soon. They've been molting. They've been getting a whole new set of feathers to get ready for their migration. They can't fly while molting, so they've been hiding out amongst the cattails and other vegetation. They'll be ready to head south in due time. Looking skyward, there'll be a full moon on the 9th. It's known as the Sturgeon Moon, which is reportedly a reference to this fish being more easily caught in and around the Great Lakes this time of year. It's also known as the Green Corn Moon and Grain Moon. And if you're interested in falling stars, the Delta Aquarius meteor shower will run through August 23rd, and the Perseids meteor shower will run until August 24th, with its peak viewing period coming on the 12th. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 7th. The Homestead Act of 1862 attracted new settlers to Dakota Territory. Some settled in towns, but most were drawn by the promise of owning 160 acres to start farms and ranches. New towns were small and scattered across the territory. They supported agriculture as centers of trade, services, entertainment, and social life. North Dakota is a state of many small towns. More than 100 have fewer than 1,000 residents. Many have fewer than 500. About 11% of the state's population lives in towns of 1,000 or less. On this date in 1880, Evan Johnson paid the United States government $400 for 160 acres of land, just $2.50 per acre. Johnson sold 4 acres to William Kindred. That October, Kindred platted a town and named it for John C. Hunter, a local landowner. He officially registered Hunter, North Dakota, in Cass County on May 28, 1881. The town began to grow quickly. The Gale Duffany General Store opened in 1881, followed by another store, a school, and a bank. In 1885, residents voted to incorporate Hunter. By 1887, the town had grown to about 400 people. Hunter kept growing. Over the next few years, it added 6 grain elevators, 3 churches, 2 blacksmiths, a hardware store, 2 more general stores, a men's store, and an ironworks. 2 hotels opened, along with a restaurant, 2 saloons, and 2 newspapers. Farmers and ranchers didn't go to town often, and when they did, they planned carefully. As more businesses opened, they could take care of everything in one trip. Hunter had 2 livery stables, a drugstore, a jewelry store, and 2 meat markets. Ladies could shop for hats at the millinery, while their husbands and sons visited the barber shop. They picked up mail at the post office, bought gear at the harness shop, and stopped by the doctor's office. The population grew to 500, and the town even boasted a 10-piece brass band and a 5-piece orchestra. Hunter is in Cass County, and according to the 2020 census, its population was 332. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
In a small town, 17 children, all from only one teacher's classroom, mysteriously go missing. That parent's worst nightmare is now a film titled Weapons.
Why just her classroom? Why only hers?
Actor Josh Brolin says he stayed away from movies like this for a long time. Hear why this one caught his attention on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy asks the question, is a re-industrialized America still possible? And what would it look like? And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. Monday on Main Street, can a $12.6 million pilot program keep rural grocery stores alive in North Dakota? Ellen Huber explains how a new food hub and distribution network could lower costs, boost access to local products, and fight food deserts across the state. And education expert Darcy Backegaard shares smart, practical tips for parents, from routines and reading to screen time and teacher communication, to help families start the school year off on the right foot. Until then, have a great North Dakota weekend. Stay conscious of the weather, and we look forward to seeing you again right here on Main Street.